Security Director Assistance for the Americas region, Paul Doucette, recently returned from Jamaica, where he conducted one of International SOS's regular country assessment trips, in which he spoke to partners on the ground and re-examined the security environment. The visit followed the US State Department's change to its travel advice for Jamaica, suggesting people should reconsider visiting the island due to high crime and limited medical services. Hello and welcome to this Global Situation podcast from International SOS, the leading health and security risk services company. I'm Chris Giles, and I'm pleased to say that Paul Doucette is with me to speak about his findings. So Paul, tell me a bit more about your trip.
Yeah, so I was in Jamaica for about a full week, and my visit on the ground took me to a lot of different parts of the island, including the beach resort areas, of which there's three main ones that attract a lot of tourists. So there's the Montego Bay resort area itself, which is kind of the most well-known because that's where the main international port of entry is, but also another popular beach destination called Negril and another one called Ocho Rios that are to the east and west, respectively, of Montego Bay. And I also drove across the island down to the capital, Kingston, and explored the capital and its surroundings. I met with a lot of diplomatic partners of ours, as well as our security partners on the ground. I did some hotel assessments and assessed the medical infrastructure of the city as well. Additionally, I also met with the disaster response agency for the country, which was extremely useful too because of one of the main big picture risks being the possibility of a natural disaster affecting it and our need to be adequately prepared to respond and support our clients in the event that a major earthquake or hurricane were to impact the island.
And Paul, how has the security situation in Jamaica evolved in recent years, particularly with the dynamics with the country's infamous gangs?
So in recent years, the gang dynamics have remained relatively static. There are changes around the margins, clearly, as there always are, with turfs changing between one gang controlling territory up to a certain road, for example, and then those lines changing. Where the real changes have happened in the bigger picture in Jamaica, and what a lot of people are familiar with when they understand some of the history of the country, is the old system with gangs being mostly active and funded by political patronage, which was kind of the old way that things in Jamaica worked. You had political parties that had gangs that were affiliated and whom they paid for support to intimidate voters one way or another, either to vote or not to vote, or to carry out incidents that were politically motivated against rivals and so on. But that old system of political patronage of gangs has really been overtaken by a system where the gangs have found ways to make far more money than they could ever make through their association with political parties. That includes things like scams, most prominently, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but also extortion rackets, drug trafficking, arms smuggling, and other types of classic criminal enterprises. Scams, though, have been the predominant moneymaker, and it has some interesting implications for the nature of violence in the country, as well as the threat to foreign nationals.
So give us an idea about how that all works.
The way these scams work, and locally, they're mostly referred to by the catch-all phrase of lotto scams. So they're called lotto scams because the most classic form of the scam is simply that through a network of individuals who are involved, there is personally identifiable information, PII, obtained about individuals, usually somewhere in the United States. There's then a phone call placed to that individual, leveraging the knowledge of their personal information to tell them that they've won a lottery. Perhaps someone's daughter or granddaughter or something to this effect has entered them in a lottery unbeknownst to them. They've won, and in order to claim their prize, they need to pay the tax amount first. So please forward a certain sum of money to this account, after which we will then give you the prize money. That type of scam involves a lot of different people. It involves people directing the operation, deciding on targets. People, one person deals with a bank, one person gets the information through maybe working at a call center, but is also associated with the gang. Another person is the one in charge of making those phone calls and being good at the social engineering aspects of it. So a lot of different people involved, all who expect to get paid. And when that money is not shared properly, it leads to violence between members of those gangs who are involved in carrying out this type of scam. So a lot of the violence has to do with that sort of monetary dispute about the rewards of those types of scam crimes.
And Paul, what does that mean for people visiting Jamaica?
What it means is that being very careful about how your personal information might leak out to nefarious actors on the ground is a really important way to protect yourself from the possible crimes that might take place, and they might take place only long after you visited. So that kind of thing, to be aware of that, I think is an important aspect of understanding the threat that you might face in going to Jamaica. And it's a very interesting and nuanced type of threat. Those dynamics are a major piece of understanding Jamaica. But then there's as well another interesting aspect, which is simply that, unlike a lot of people's expectations about Jamaica, the violence that's carried out is, as I said, typically between gangs, either intra or inter-gang violence. But the gang members themselves often have a very much a shared interest with the legal sectors of the country in maintaining generally safe environment for tourists. What they don't want is tourists getting murdered or robbed or otherwise experiencing extreme violence in some way or other, because that gets reported back in that individual's home country, and that can then dissuade more tourists from coming to Jamaica. So because of that shared problem, both the gangs and the legal sectors of the country, whether they be tourism or tour groups or whatever it may be, they all have an interest in making sure tourism keeps coming into Jamaica, because there's such a huge percentage of the economy is based on that tourism influx. So it's an interesting dynamic that, you know, some people locally, and I don't fully agree with this, but some people kind of put the point out there that Jamaica is only dangerous for Jamaicans, which is not really true. There's plenty of cases of foreigners being impacted by the violence or just the prevalence of gun ownership and so on. And there's important not to think of it in that sense entirely, but there is a certain dynamic at play where both licit and illicit sectors of the Jamaican populace and economy have a shared interest in keeping things as safe as they can for tourists in general.
So, Paul, how does the security risk situation differ between the capital and the beach resort areas?
Yeah, no, great question. So the gangs are predominantly based in the capital. So they have certainly capabilities and operations island-wide, and many of them do operate in places where more tourists go, which is mainly those beach destinations in the kind of northwestern areas, mostly in the northern coast of the country. But they do use those areas to target people for, again, a pilfering of PII. But the other way that they operate in those areas is petty robbery, things like that. And there is a network of people who are associated with those gangs in Kingston for different reasons of patronage and history. And, you know, they're deployed out there to make money from different ways, for example, drugs and so on. So the threat that's faced by tourists who are going there, though, is very different. The possibility of, for example, stumbling into the wrong neighborhood and being caught in the crossfire of a gang dispute is far lower out in the resort areas. But one thing that's brought up often is the risk of sexual assault. And this doesn't really have to do with the gang dynamics. This is just something that really can happen anywhere. It's something that's put out there a lot as a real risk in the resort areas. But of course, you know, through good advice and taking sensible precautions, you can really mitigate the risk of this happening quite significantly. And also, it's likely an overstated risk when it comes to Jamaica, simply because Jamaica is a country with a very high crime rate. Again, as mentioned earlier, a lot of that has to do with the inter and intra gang issues. However, the possibility of sexual assault, there's a risk of that almost anywhere one might go. And so likely in a country with a high crime rate, those kind of things can get exaggerated to some extent in terms of like whether the threat is much higher than it would be in many other parts of the world. It probably isn't a great deal higher, but it certainly shouldn't be dismissed and precautions should be taken.
So, Paul, regarding the advisory change by the US State Department, I wondered how that's been perceived locally and what impact do people feel it will have?
Yeah, it hasn't been received well at all locally. And the reason for that is because, as I mentioned earlier, tourism is such a critically important aspect of the Jamaican economy. So everyone is worried about that, and they're very worried about the impact it might have on the economy and about on a lot of different sectors of the economy and on the country's economic prospects as a whole. So because of that, there's a lot of speculation and rumors, which I won't get into, about why this may have happened. And we don't have the answers exactly as to the precise causes or rationale for why the decision was made by the U.S. State Department to raise the alert level. It is worth noting that other major Western countries have not changed their advice. So the UK, most of continental Europe, Canada, Australia have not changed their advice for traveling to Jamaica. Interestingly, the U.S. change did come at a time where, statistically at least, crime rates seemed to be slightly down from where they were a year ago, not up, which means that if it were to be simply to do with a change in the crime rate, that is unlikely to really have driven this change in advice. One thing that Jamaica, from their perspective, is quite concerned about is the amount of arms in circulation. They are quite keen to try to get better U.S. support for the policing of the waters around the island to prevent some of that smuggling that is known to be ongoing. A lot of the crimes that are committed locally in Jamaica are carried out using firearms that were legally purchased in the United States, but then illegally smuggled into Jamaica. So requesting that kind of support from the U.S. in terms of policing the maritime borders is something that's been a longstanding request from Jamaica of the U.S. to have some additional capacity. As a fairly small country with a fairly small population, its ability to police all of the waters around its island is a very big challenge. And so that's definitely a major concern and something that comes up quite often.
And finally, how is International SOS positioned to be able to support clients in Jamaica?
So we're very well positioned, actually, and even more so following our visit there. The security provider network is robust on the ground. We have island-wide reach through our local partners, and we have resilience in that network. So we have multiple local security companies who we work with who have excellent capability. We also have very good contacts within the police department who are able to support foreign nationals in the country, as well as locals, of course. But those avenues of support for us are excellent in terms of both road and maritime activation and access to pretty much any location around the island. And then our capability to tap into the emergency response for natural disasters that might happen through the main natural disaster response agency, OPDEM, in the capital, Kingston, is also a big boon to us to make sure that we can coordinate with local authorities or have access to their capabilities, plans, and so on, so that we're able to offer the best type of response that we can should there be a major natural disaster affecting the island, affecting our clients there. And additionally, on the medical side, while International SOS has an extensive history in providing medical assistance to our subscribers in the country and great relationships with medical providers there, and some medical care is available at international standards, medical care is not reliably available at all levels across all different types of medical care that may be needed in Jamaica. And typically, for any required medical care beyond emergency level stabilization or for lower level medical needs, we often will be discussing with our subscribers to consider medical care outside of Jamaica and medical evacuation from there to a center of medical excellence somewhere else. But that's a case by case consideration. And like we said, we do have those relationships to make sure that emergency stabilization can be carried out should there be a need for any of our clients who are on the island.
Okay, thanks, Paul, for all your analysis and advice.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for now, but just a reminder that you'll be able to access all the latest information and updates about Jamaica from our website. That's internationalsos.com. And from there, you can find out about our global network of assistance centres, available to clients 24/7. But until next time, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.